one of the unfortunate things which the Miller Center has at least tried to correct has been that quite exciting people come into the university. They do a little research or teach a few courses, but nobody else sees them. And that has always just seemed to me is unfortunate, especially when somebody has as much to contribute as Professor Nogi has or as Professor David Butler from our last week program has. Professor Nogi is clearly one of the most respected scholars in the field of international relations, Soviet-American relations, and the field of international institutions. He's professor at Houston University, formerly Henry Stimson Professor at the U.S. Army War College. He received his Bachelor's of Foreign Service at the Georgetown School of Foreign Service, his Master's at the University of Chicago, and his PhD from Yale University, where he was a Junior Sterling Fellow twice. He's the author of Soviet Policy Toward the International Control of Atomic Energy, co-author with John Spanier, another very well-known scholar in international politics, of the book The Politics of Disarmament, a study of Soviet-American gamesmanship. He's co-author again with Spanier of The Congress, the Presidency, and American Foreign Policy, and also the book Soviet Foreign Policy Since World War II with Robert Donaldson. But the book most relevant to our topic of today and that lays the foundation for it is the book Peace Impossible, War Unlikely, The Cold War in U.S.-Soviet Relations, 1988. He's received numerous awards and grants, and I'm proud to say one of them was from the Rockefeller Foundation in 1963-64.
Were you there?
I'm very happy to introduce one of the wise men in the field of international politics, Joe Nogi.
Thank you, Ken, for a very generous introduction. And I might say I'm somewhat overawed by this very distinguished group around me, and it's a pleasure to be here. The topic that I'd like to discuss with you is the question of the Cold War. You probably know that among academics, journalists, and government people, there's been a debate for some time now as to whether or not the Cold War may now be over. In fact, just a few weeks ago, I cut this out of the New York Times. Its judgment rendered was that the Cold War is over. Now, not everyone agrees. Our National Security Affairs Advisor, General Scowcroft, does not believe that the Cold War is over. On the other hand, Margaret Thatcher does. Scholars are very divided. Yaller at Columbia, John Gaddis, the historian, do not think it's over. George Kennan, on the other hand, does think it's over. Now, I think there's no question that since 1987, clearly, there has been a very significant shift in U.S.-Soviet relations, that we are in or are moving toward a new détente. The question is whether or not this is a phase in U.S.-Soviet relations like we've had before. The history of U.S.-Soviet relations has been an alternation between periods of tension and relaxation of tension, détente, and Cold War. And the question is whether this new shift is something permanent, fundamental, or simply an alteration that has characterized relations in the past. Now, my view is that the Cold War is an extraordinarily complex relationship which cannot be explained in terms of any single one cause or one factor. It's the longest war the United States has ever been involved in, or the Soviet Union for that matter. And it may be the second longest war in all of recorded history. I'm not sure about that. But obviously a conflict as long and intense as the Cold War is not the product of any one cause. And one of the books that Professor Thompson referred to was an attempt by myself and a colleague to analyze what we considered to be the major roots of the war. And we focused essentially on three basic factors, all each quite different from the other, as a contributing factor to the Cold War. One had to do with what I would call a geostrategic competition that derives essentially from the balance of power in U.S.-Soviet relations. The second has to do with the nature of the Soviet political culture and its conflict with our political culture. And the third has to do with perceptions and misperceptions on the part of leaders and elites and publics on both sides. No one of these factors, in my judgment, caused or perpetuates the war. They contribute together to create this basic conflict. Now, the Cold War began in the aftermath of the Second World War, basically as a result of the collapse of any political power in Europe through the defeat of Germany and the expansion of the Soviet Union into Eastern Europe and threatening to dominate all of Europe. This is essentially the geopolitical factor that gave birth to the Cold War and incidentally explains why, notwithstanding the fact that there was a Soviet Union well before 1945, there really wasn't a Cold War. The Cold War arose as a result of the determination on the part of the United States to resist Soviet domination of all of Europe. In the 20th century, the United States has gone to war twice to prevent the domination of Europe by any one power. We believe that it is in our interest that our ultimate security rests on the non-domination of European continent by any one power. And those policies that we associate with containment, the Truman Doctrine, the Marshall Plan, NATO, and so on, and the arms race that's occurred since the beginning are all essentially balance of power policies. Now, when the Soviet Union and China aligned in 1950, followed shortly thereafter by the Korean War, what started out as essentially a regional competition became, in effect, global. And it's largely been that way since. So one factor, then, which I think is extremely important in understanding the Cold War, is what has become the bipolar structure of the international system. The United States and the Soviet Union, by virtue of the fact that both are great powers, in fact superpowers, would to some extent inevitably be in conflict, no matter what the internal makeup of either political system. Now, the second factor, which I believe is extremely important in terms of the conflict between the two superpowers, has to do with the nature of the Soviet political system, its political culture, and the conflict between the values inherent in that culture and the United States political culture. The Soviet political culture is one that's has been characterized by an aggressive expansionism, by an antagonism toward the non-Soviet world, toward suspicion of the outside world, and a kind of obsessive concern with security. Now, these elements of the Soviet political culture have themselves many different roots. Some of these roots go back to Russian history, some have to do with ideology and doctrine, and some have to do with the nature of the Soviet system itself, which is neither Russian nor Marxist in character. Most of you know that Russia has a long history of conflict with its neighbors. Much of that history is the result of aggression that has been perpetrated by outside forces against Russia. But there's been virtually no period in the Russian past when it has not been involved in very, very profound, deep conflict with its neighbors. I mean, you can go back to the 13th and the 14th century, when for 200 years the country was overrun by the ancestors of the present-day Chinese. I mean, Swedes, Poles, Germans, French have all invaded with devastating consequences the country. And partly as a result of this, there has developed certain attitudes toward the outside world within that are what we might call characteristically Russian, a certain suspiciousness, a concern with security, a need for a strong military power force to protect itself. And the very autocratic character of the Russian regime in part is the result of this geopolitical insecurity with which it has lived most of its history. So that's one factor contributing to the political culture. Another is the ideological. The doctrines that we associate with Marxist-Leninist theory tend to reinforce the adversarial nature between the Soviet Union and the non-communist world. In other words, it tends to reinforce those attitudes and outlooks that go deep in Russian history. Marxism, Leninism emphasizes the notion of politics as conflict. With Marx, it was class conflict. With Lenin, it was the conflict between imperialistic and non-imperialistic states. You might also note that the utopianism inherent in socialism also reinforces traditional Russian messianism. A third factor in the political culture is the Soviet factor. The Soviet system as it has developed is not Russian. It's not Marxist. It's a rather unique type of authoritarian system. And aspects of that system have contributed to the conflict of our political cultures. Now, one of the problems of the Soviet system is that from the very beginning, the regime has had to deal with the problem of legitimacy. By what right do those who govern rule in Soviet society? This problem has created a kind of insecurity on the part of Soviet leaders. There are many different bases on which legitimacy might be derived. The czars relied on divine right. Democratic societies rely on the idea of popular sovereignty as expressed through elections. Soviets have neither. They neither rely on divine right, nor until quite recently, last month in fact, have elections had any real meaning in Soviet political life at all. And even that has to be very sharply qualified. The legitimacy in the Soviet system relies essentially on two sources, doctrine and performance. Marxist-Leninist, particularly Lenin's doctrine, asserts the right of the party to dominate as because of its special role in history. But that doctrine involves the acceptance of a whole complex of what I would call myths that many of which very sharply conflict with reality. I mean, the myth that, for example, that the revolution in 1917 was a workers' revolution, a Marxist revolution, which it really was not. The myth that the Communist Party represents the vanguard of the working class. The myth of popular sovereignty in the Soviet Union, or the myth that the nationalities in the Soviet Union have self-determination and are freely exercising their own sovereignty. So, to the extent that these myths conflict with reality, the legitimacy is undermined, or the extent to which people don't believe in the doctrines undermines Soviet legitimacy. Now, the other basis on which legitimacy rests is performance. And here the Soviets do have some basis for establishing the right of those to rule to rule. I think unquestionably the most important factor was the success of the regime in defeating the Germans in the Second World War. That, without any question, added enormously to the legitimacy of Soviet leaders. And then following that, the acquisition of nuclear weapons by the Soviet Union, the growth of the Soviet Union from a regional to a truly world power and a superpower. These have all contributed to the legitimacy of the Soviet leaders. But there are many aspects of the performance of the Soviet leaders that have undermined that legitimacy as well. And we see this particularly in the domestic field, and particularly now the failure of the Soviet economy to provide a decent standard of living, given the very enormous resources that the country possesses, and the economic policies themselves are undermining this legitimacy. So, to sum it up then there are Soviet, there are the ideological, there are traditional Russian factors that contribute to this, what I would sum it all up as a political culture, which puts the Soviet regime at odds with the values that we in the United States and in the West hold. Now, the third factor contributing to the Cold War, and one which operates at an entirely different level than geopolitical or the domestic character of the Soviet regime, has to do with the perceptions of individuals and leaders and the decisions that are based on those perceptions. Indeed, from the very beginning, there has been enormous misreading and misperception on the part of both sides regarding the intentions and the capabilities of the other. We could go back to Yalta and the misperception that the U.S. administration had regarding Soviet intentions in Eastern Europe. The phenomenon of McCarthyism is a classic example of grossly misreading the reality and the impact of that on U.S.-Soviet relations. The missile gaps, the bomber gaps, the fear in the United States when the Soviets sent their Sputnik aloft that we were falling behind in science and they were overtaking us and so on. The idea of monolithic communism is another gross misperception in the policies that were based on that. So let me just sum all this up by saying that the Cold War is a product of many forces. The three that I would focus on in particular, the geostrategic struggle to maintain a balance of power, the aggressiveness and suspicion that are characteristic of Soviet political culture, and at a different level, the misunderstanding of and misperception that individuals and elites on both sides have held toward the other. Now, the question that I want to briefly consider is, does Gorbachev change this? There has been no question that the Gorbachev leadership has had a profound effect on U.S.-Soviet relations. I would argue that the problems of the Cold War are deeper and more intractable than are likely to be resolved in a short period of time by one administration. And I think it's interesting to point out that while we attribute this enormous change to the personality and the leadership of one man, Gorbachev, it's important to note that it didn't begin with his administration when he came into office in March of 1985. In fact, his administration very, very sharply divides into two distinct phases, the period from 85, 86, and the period since 87 and since. I don't want to take the time here to review U.S.-Soviet relations during 85 and 86, but let me point out, if you go back, it's quite clear they were not good. Gorbachev was essentially pursuing the policies that he inherited from his predecessors in foreign affairs. Now, domestically, he was introducing glasnost and perestroika, but for a period of time, he tried desperately to win the war in Afghanistan. He accelerated Soviet involvement and enormously increased the casualties on both sides. The first two summits at Geneva and Reykjavik were very sharp maneuvering on the part of him as well as Reagan for political advantage. You remember the Danilov affair and the antagonism that it generated. The way the Soviets handled Chernobyl was quite at odds with the whole idea of glasnost. Soviet rhetoric was very, very sharp. I mean, I could give you a lot of examples where their attack on the United States was sharp and consistent. We were consistently on the wrong side of every issue as far as the Soviet Union was concerned. Now, this did change, and it changed rather abruptly, in my opinion. I date the change in Soviet foreign policy with a special meeting of the Central Committee that took place in January of 1987, a plenum, which had to be postponed twice, which is very rare for Central Committee plenums in the Soviet Union, and which indicated there must have been a very sharp debate going on within the Soviet leadership regarding foreign policy and other issues. We know that at that plenum, Gorbachev came out and acknowledged that his perestroika wasn't working, that the problems were deeper than he had anticipated when he came into office, and that the changes were going to have to be more radical, and that they were going to have to include not only domestic but foreign policy changes as well. We also know at that plenum that he was able to change a number of the leaders within the ruling oligarchy of the party. He removed two holdovers from the Brezhnev period and added three of his own supporters to the Politburo, which probably gave him a working majority. And incidentally, what happened this week in the Central Committee seems to me to be a consolidation of the changes that have been going on piecemeal over time, and which now, in my opinion, probably give him very, very substantial control over the party leadership. In any event, within a month of that Central Committee plenum, Gorbachev made the first of several very significant concessions that have brought about this change. He announced that the Soviet Union was prepared to negotiate a reduction or the elimination of intermediate nuclear forces in Europe, independent of any other issue, strategic weapons, space weapons, SDI, or anything. And that was followed not too long after by the acceptance of the zero option, then the zero-zero option, and the opening up of the Soviet Union to inspection to meet U.S. demands.
you had the withdrawal, the decision to withdraw from Afghanistan, Soviet, the change in Soviet behavior in the Third World, an encouragement of its allies and clients in the Third World to negotiate some of their differences, such as we've seen resulting in Angola with the withdrawal of Cuban forces and from Angola, and so on, and then the announced military cuts, and so on, and so on. He's been consistent, and he is consistent since that time. I would argue that in large part he is operating from a position of weakness and out of necessity because of the conditions that he is encountering at home and the need for change there. Now, let me very briefly review what I consider to be the major problems that stand in the way of U.S.-Soviet relations that I think will need to be overcome before I am convinced that the Cold War really is over. First of all, the United States and the Soviet Union still have quite a different vision of what kind of a world each would like to see. The United States seeks an international order in which legitimacy rests upon conformity with democratic processes. That is our commitment. This is not the Soviet commitment. The Soviet are prepared to see a world order composed of one-party regimes based upon Marxist-Leninist principles. We want to see an international economy where exchanges are based upon market principles. The Soviets are still committed to a global economy where exchanges are based upon state-controlled economies. In other words, I do not think that the ideological issues that divide us are by any means removed at this point. Now, we've heard a lot about the de-emphasis in ideology in the Soviet Union, and I think that's real. I think the thrust of Gorbachev's revision of Soviet doctrine is to consolidate one very, very simple point which does dominate Soviet foreign policy and its objectives, and that is the necessity under no circumstances to become involved in a war with the United States or to become involved in a nuclear war. The avoidance of a nuclear war is the number one priority in the Soviet Union, as it is with us, I think. This is not necessarily new, but I think this is the thrust of Gorbachev's ideological revisions. If you look at his statements made domestically to this day, they still reaffirm the legitimacy of Marxist-Leninist principles, and he has in no way repudiated the Leninist distinction between imperialism and socialism, in the character of their system and the character of our system. If you look at the world and the Soviet relationship with countries in different parts of the world, by and large, the strongest relationships that the Soviets have in the different parts of the world are either with Marxist governments or with very strongly anti-American governments. In Africa, Ethiopia and Angola. In Asia, Vietnam and North Korea. In Latin America, Cuba and Nicaragua. In the Middle East, Syria and Libya. Either Marxist or very strongly anti-U.S. Governments. Though they have reduced their activity in some areas of the Third World, they have by no means diminished their economic and military support to their clients in the Third World. Last year, the Soviets gave Angola in slightly in excess of $1.5 billion of military and economic aid. They gave the Sandinistas in Nicaragua just under $1 billion in military and economic aid. In Cuba, the astounding sum of in excess of $5 billion. Now, one might ask, what Soviet interest is served by pumping up the Cuban economy and the Cuban military to the tune of that sum of money if it is not in the context of a confrontation with the United States. Another issue that stands as a barrier, in my estimation, is the division in Europe. Now, in one sense, that issue was somewhat resolved at the Helsinki, with the Helsinki Agreement in the mid-1970s. But I don't believe that the Helsinki Agreement has resolved the fundamental political problem of European division, because basically the peoples of Eastern Europe were not represented at that conference. I think it is clear that the peoples of Eastern Europe have not and still do not accept the permanence and the finality and the legitimacy of the changes that were imposed upon them in the post-war period. And until the issue of self-determination is resolved in Europe, as it is elsewhere, I think this is going to be a problem. One might ask, what is the justification for Soviet domination of Eastern Europe? Is it security? I don't think so. I mean, I do not believe that Germany is today a threat to the Soviet Union. Is it economic? That's no longer true either. The Eastern Europe is an economic liability to the Soviet Union by a very substantial margin. Is it ideological? Do they insist on communist governments in Eastern Europe for ideological reasons? Perhaps. Or it may be that the Soviets fear national self-determination in Eastern Europe because of the impact that this will have within the Soviet Union itself, which is a multinational society, some of whose elements clearly are not happy with the character of the Soviet system as it applies to them. So that's a problem. The geopolitical problem continues to exist. So long as the United States and the Soviet Union both possess enormous nuclear and conventional military capabilities that are military forces that are capable of destroying each other's sides, inevitably there's going to be a tension and rivalry. Let me conclude by indicating what I think it would take to end the Cold War. And let me say that I do not see the Cold War as an inevitable and permanent feature of international life. I think it will end. I'm not convinced that it has ended. I would argue that before it ends, there's going to have to be certain changes in the international system and changes of perception that that reflect these changes of events. And I would identify, first, there would have to be substantial disarmament in Europe and the dissolution of both NATO and the Warsaw Pact. I don't mean the absolute, complete, and general disarmament. That's not possible. But a very considerable reduction of military forces and the dissolution of both alliances. There's going to have to be self-determination for Germany and the peoples of Eastern Europe. There's going to have to be very substantial reductions in nuclear stockpiles on the part of the two superpowers. I don't, again, believe it's possible for nuclear abolition, as Mr. Reagan and as Mr. Gorbachev have called for at different points, but there has to be a very significant reduction from existing inventories. There's going to have to be an abandonment of the competition in the Third World, and that's going to involve not just Soviet, but U.S. cooperation as well. And finally, there's going to have to be a change in the Soviet system, essentially along the lines that Gorbachev has been attempting to bring about. There's no doubt, in my opinion, that Gorbachev is moving in the right direction, and personally, I hope he succeeds.
There is a theory, I wonder if you'd want to comment on that, that one way the Cold War would end would be with a Soviet German rapprochement. And a lot of commentators have been writing recently about the uncertainty and the restiveness in West Germany and the movement of large groups of German technicians and economic planners to meetings with the Soviet, evidently in spite of our thought that the whole of NATO would oppose that. Why, there's an article I'm sure you saw yesterday saying that a number of the NATO countries are not as much opposed to that kind of rapprochement. Could anything happen in that area that you think would bring the Cold War to an end, perhaps in the wrong way? Because we've always said that if there was ever a reunification and a rapprochement between Germany and the Soviet Union, then in effect the Soviet Union would have won the Cold War.
There, first of all, are changes taking place both in East Germany and West Germany that are undoubtedly going to have profound impact on NATO and East-West relations. Increasingly, there is within Europe a declining perception of the Soviet Union as a military threat, and thus an unwillingness to pay the price that many argue has to be paid in order to maintain a military defense against that threat. Now, I'm not sure I'm responsive to your question, if you'll not push me more, but clearly the Soviets do want a rapprochement with Germany. This has traditionally been seen as a part of the Soviet strategy to divide NATO. And if you look at it in that context then, it's what you might call an adversarial strategy of weakening your enemy. In my view, the real question is whether or not the Soviets are prepared to see East and West Germany reunified. We don't really know to what extent this meets with popular aspirations within Germany, both Germanies themselves. The assumption has often been that ultimately this is what the German people themselves would choose if they had the opportunity to make that choice. And the question is whether or not this would be acceptable to the Soviet Union, the reunification of Germany, because it's generally been argued that everything that the Soviets have done in Europe has been to protect them against the German threat. You know, they were attacked by Germany twice in this century with the devastating consequences in both cases. And that undoubtedly is a very powerful part of the memory of it. If Germany were unified, obviously, it could not be done in the context of the existing alliance structure in Europe. That is to say, Germany would have to be, could not be a NATO. Germany could not be a part of NATO. They really could not even be a NATO. And then that raises the question, are we prepared to accept a German reunification and the dissolution of NATO? What about Europe? Is Europe prepared to accept that? Probably on the answer to all these questions, there are sharply divided views on it. My opinion, though, is that in ultimately, whatever solution is worked out for Europe has to be in conformity with the basic aspirations of the peoples of Europe themselves. I'm assuming that Germans do want to be unified. I'm assuming that the governments of Poland, Hungary, Czechoslovakia, Romania do not want what they now have. They're, obviously, they cannot pursue an anti-Russian or anti-Soviet policy as some of these governments did in the interwar period. They understand that only too well. But that what I'm hypothesizing for them is something in the nature of what Finland and Austria have, which are pursue foreign policies compatible with the Soviet Union and yet maintain domestic internal self-governance. And it's not clear to me at this point that the Soviet Union is prepared to accept that. Now, I say I might not be responsive to your question, but that's...
Other questions? Bill Wemple?
Doesn't it seem strange that Margaret Thatcher would publicly express the view that the Cold War is over in view of the long history of Great Britain's principal aim of maintaining a balance of power on the continent so that no one power could become too dominant?
Yeah, it is a little surprising given her position on defense issues and so on. I don't know whether David Butler got into this, but I think he could probably shed more light than I can on the thinking of the Conservative Party and Ms. Thatcher on it. I think, though, we don't really know exactly the full extent of what her idea of the Cold War was and what she meant by that. But I, what I think she was saying is that Gorbachev's domestic and foreign policies have brought a very fundamental change in the character of Soviet foreign policy, such that the prospects for war are not likely in the near future. But clearly, she still sees the Soviet Union as a threat, or she would not be so determined to press the modernization of the British nuclear deterrent, for example. What purpose does that serve if there's no Cold War? Or if you don't view in some way the Soviet Union as a major potential threat? It's not directed against the United States or France or anybody else. The British nuclear deterrent is for the Soviet Union.
And the modernization of lands. And she also came
that's the, yeah, that's right. I mean, she is. In fact, the British are probably the strongest allies the United States has in Europe for the modernization of nuclear weapons. There's an enormous erosion of support for that idea in Europe. But the British are very, very strong in that. So I'm not sure exactly what she meant by that, or what she meant when she said, we can do business with Gorbachev. I mean, probably had a slightly different conception of it than what we take her words to mean.
Next question. Yes, Victor Yonke.
Professor Nogi, I believe you touched on the possibility of self-determination in Europe, which raises a whole host of problems. And when you go back to 1919, reestablishing the borders then, what about the groups, the Polish connection in Germany, Hungarian people in Romania? What was all that shifting? Would it take place with a certain amount of turmoil?
Right. Well, I don't think one can apply the principle of national self-determination universally and absolutely everywhere. It would lead to utter chaos, not only in Europe, but almost everywhere else in the world. Central America, Latin America, Africa, certainly, and Asia, and so on. So one has to recognize certain constraints and limitations on that idea. But I'm talking about national self-determination in the sense of reflecting the wills of large national communities in Europe. Poles, Czechs, Germans, and so on. We're not talking about minorities, small numbers of people in that comprise a larger state, where for geographic or whatever other reasons it's not possible for all of them to be absolutely self-determining. I mean, if in the Soviet Union you have well over 100 distinct nationalities, 22 of them are more than 1 million in population. There's no way, in any realistic sense, many of these don't even have borders on foreign countries. I mean, they're in the interior of the country. There's no way that every people everywhere can have their own state, if that's what you mean by self-determination. But large national groupings should. I mean, I think, again, Poles and the Czechs and the Germans, for example, are too important a population not to have their political future governed by themselves.
In an entirely different area, I've been very much mystified by the alleged use of the nerve gas in Georgia, because it would tend to undermine the credibility of the whole disarmament approach. And it must mean, is this an aberration or?
Well, I would say yes, it is an aberration. I accept Gorbachev's explanation that the leadership in Moscow did not know of the specific any kind of violent demonstrations, but nobody could foresee exactly the form that these demonstrations would take and the response that might be necessary to contain them.
The gas that was used, as far as I understand it, is not really the kind of gas that would be used in warfare against an enemy like the Iranians and the Iraqis and others would use, but a variant of the tear gas that could be used for riot control purposes. But apparently the concentration was too strong, reached a point of lethality, and you had the consequences that you did. But I would say, to answer your question, I think it was a mistake. Mistakes do happen, even in the Soviet Union, that Gorbachev really cannot be held responsible for that. And we've already seen heads have rolled in Georgia as a consequence. Professor Miller, you're headed for the Soviet Union. What questions are you going to ask the Soviets? Are any of the questions you asked Professor Nogi?
Well, I don't know how much return to ask Soviets, but very much of anything. I was the most interesting part of it, I believe, was your question, which brought up the whole business of the relationship between the Soviet Union and Germany, and the division of Germany, like with a reunion. It's always been almost impossible for you to visualize the reunion of Germany in the lifetime of anybody now living, unless there's more of a radical revolutionary change everywhere than there has been. But everything is possible. Hitler came and went within 12 years. Would you care to make a prediction as to the likelihood of the removal of the Berlin Wall, for example, and some relaxation between the Germans, even though we don't have full, complete reunion?
Mm-hmm. Well, there are a lot of possible solutions to the German problem other than reunion. I mean, you could have, for example, a different kind of East German state as well, one that more nearly reflected the desires of the population of East Germany. Let me say, I have no doubt in my own mind that the peoples of East Germany, though they've been rather quiescent since 1953, and 1953 was the last time you had a popular uprising in East Germany, that they no more accept their government than do the people of Poland or Czechoslovakia or Hungary, for that matter. But I know what you mean when you say that the idea of reunification goes against a lot of people's grains. There are a lot of people in West Germany who would have resistance to unification. It would very substantially change the whole political structure of the unified Germany. For example, the Christian Democrats would probably become a very a distinct minority party if East and West Germany is unified. I mean, the potential for the SPD is much greater than, say, the CDU in unification. There are Europeans for whom the memory of Nazism and so on is very, very alive, as well as the Soviets. So there are a lot of different factors that would go against unification. Perhaps the creation of a binational state, a confederation of some sort might be possible, or two separate but both democratic states might be possible. The existence of the Berlin Wall is itself an expression of the fear of Eastern authorities about what would happen if barriers were completely let down. You know, since the erection of the wall in 1961, which stopped an enormous hemorrhaging of refugees from east to west, one of the largest peacetime flows of refugees in all of European history up to that point, was stopped. But even since then, since the wall, there have been more than 600,000 Eastern Europeans that have fled east to west, which is an example of the fact that the people of Eastern Europe do not accept the finality and the permanence of the status quo. But I couldn't predict when the wall would go down. I think when the wall goes down, a big step has been taken toward a genuine European unity.
Next question. Yes, Mr. Stevens. If Gorbachev does not survive, what will happen to his policies?
I think that his policies will survive in some form, because I don't think they're rooted simply in the personality of the man. You have a conjunction of circumstances which dictate the necessity of these policies, along with the individual who provides the leadership. And I think that some other leadership will move ultimately along the lines that Gorbachev has moved, because the circumstances economically and politically in the Soviet Union are such that the old policies weren't working. And the incredible thing about Gorbachev is not that he's done what he's done, but that somebody didn't do it sooner. I mean, Khrushchev tried to, but Khrushchev lacked a lot of the skills necessary to bring it about. And there were a lot of factors that undermined Khrushchev. In the initial period of the Brezhnev administration, there were attempts at reform, economic reform. In fact, every Soviet leadership since Stalin has come into office committed to changing things. And they've all tried. They've all failed up to this point, because the obstacles to success are very, very substantial. But I think that that Gorbachev's successors will probably move in the same direction as Gorbachev has been trying. I don't think he's going to succeed in the near future. I think what we're going to see in the Soviet Union is crisis for years and years to come.
David Clinton? You began the question period by talking about the chances of the Soviet Union winning the Cold War. When you talked about what would have to happen for the Cold War to end, a measure of national self-determination for peoples and the lack of domination by any one power of the whole of Europe, it sounded very much like what the United States had been trying to accomplish in the Cold War. Do you believe the only way the Cold War will end is in effect the United States wins it?
I don't like to use these terms like win and lose, because they carry with them a certain kind of emotional baggage. In one sense, I agree with those who argue the United States has won the Cold War in the sense that it is contained to stop the spread of communism. And not just communism, but Soviet influence throughout the world. But to say that, and when you say won, that implies a kind of finality to it. In one sense, you can say the Soviets have won the Cold War in the sense that they've survived. Survived intact. They still maintain the control that they acquired in Europe in 1945 through 1947. So I don't think there's clear-cut winner or loser. What I tend to see it as a complex of conflicting objectives, some of which we've won and some of which they have won. But until these objectives cease to be conflicting, the conflict I see is not ended.
Professor Farnbaugh.
Yeah.
Joe, shouldn't we consider the dilemmas facing the Soviet Union now in the economic field in the context of the whole globe? The Soviet Union isn't alone in the problem of how you convert from a totalitarian, centrally directed economy to a at least relatively market-oriented economy. I think in this room, if we made a tribute 2 or 3 weeks ago, the polls kind of said Solidarity wouldn't know what to do if it won an election right now. In terms of how you make this transition. The Hungarians are grappling with it from the top down, but without too much success thus far. The Chinese are worried about it, etc., etc. The Argentines are worried about it. The Mexicans are trying to ease it with some success, but the whole world is, in a sense, watching the groping of many states in this process about which we have very little experience. Our own experience, it seems to me, is so different. It occurred over centuries, or at least over decades, and they've got to try and catch up in a few years. So I wonder whether the Soviet Union isn't in a league with other countries all trying to find out and learn from each other how to do this. And in this connection, I find East Germany among the slowest to start. And not encouraged to start much by the Poles or the Hungarians or the Czechs, as well as people in the West.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, East Germany is an interesting case because it's one of the few examples of a controlled or centrally planned economy that does has achieved a certain measure of success. And raises the question of why. What is it that impels people to be productive, to be energetic, to be hardworking? We tend to think of it in terms of the structure of the economy, the opportunities that the market economy and individual initiative give. This is not everybody, as you well know, not everybody within a capitalistic or market economy prospers by any means. We have big pockets of poverty in our own society. In the case of Germany, apparently, there's something about the German culture. I don't like to use the term national character. They're hardworking people. And they'll work hard even in a totalitarian or authoritarian system. And that is a contributing factor. But I agree with you that the problem of how to build a successful economy is one that we don't really have the answer to. I mean, we're inclined to think that the principles under which we operate are better
than any alternative that we know, but we know they don't work well everywhere, just as we've seen in the case of, you can have planned economies that do achieve a significant level of accomplishment. But I don't know the answer to that. When you get into international economics, that is almost as difficult as international politics, or maybe even more so.
Might there not be some virtue in continuing a cool war, since the Cold War has kept in place for some 45 years? A cool war.
Yeah.
In other words, I still think you have to take a somewhat, since it's natural, I think a somewhat adversarial condition with a little more reason, perhaps, and which involves some cooperation, but still recognize that we are adversaries and continue that. It's worked well for 45 years.
Uh-huh. Well, I think that's in part where we're moving toward more of a cool rather than a cold, and then maybe the temperatures will start to get warmer and we'll be talking about a warm peace or something like that. Whether or not the Cold War were in existence, the United States as a great power, the Soviet Union as a great power, would be to some measure rivals anyway.
Mm.
Maybe not to the same, I don't think, to the same extent that they are. And have been since the end of the Second World War, but they would be rivals. There would be a certain, there is an antagonism that is inherent.
And it may be healthy.
Well, you could argue that.
We try to begin on the hour and end on the hour, so perhaps we ought to bring this to a close. I hope in bringing to it to a close, however, that Professor Nogi knows that he's only begun the discussion of the ending of the Cold War, and he'll undoubtedly be coming back to the University of Virginia in the future for one purpose or another. And we hope that one of those purposes will be to meet again with us at the Miller Center. Thank you very, very much.
I'd be happy to do it.